I add this for a reason, too. I know this isn't a fair assumption, but I'm afraid that a female therapist might be predisposed to empathize with me post-breakup, and that a male therapist who's neither married nor a father won't understand the nuances of the kid part of the situation. In short, I want to see if an objective male professional who has first-hand experience of marriage and kids, a man just like boyfriend, will be as appalled by boyfriend's behavior as I am. Because then I'll know that my reaction is normal and I'm not going insane after all. Yes, I'm seeking objectivity, but only because I'm convinced that objectivity will rule in my favor. I hear Caroline clicking away on her keyboard. Tap, tap, tap. How about... No, scratch that. He thinks much too highly of himself, she says of some unnamed therapist. She goes back to her keyboard. Tap, tap, tap. There's a colleague who used to be in my consultation group, she begins. But I'm not sure. He's great, very skilled. He always has insightful things to say. It's just... Caroline hesitates. Just what? He's so happy all the time. It feels unnatural. Like, what the hell is he so happy about? But some patients like that. Do you think your friend would do well with him? Definitely not, I say. I, too, am suspicious of chronically happy people. Next, Caroline names a good therapist I also know relatively well. So I tell her that he won't work out for my friend because there's a conflict. Therapist shorthand for, their worlds collide, but I can't reveal more. She clicks around again. Tap, tap, tap. Then stops. Oh, hey, there's a psychologist named Wendell Bronson, Caroline says. I haven't talked to him in years, but we trained together, and he's smart. Married with kids, late 40s or so. Been doing this a long time. Do you want his info? I say I do. I mean, my friend does. We exchange some pleasantries and then hang up. At this point, all I know about Wendell is what Caroline has just told me, and that there's 2-hour free parking in the lot across the street from his office. I know about the parking, because when Caroline texts me his phone number and address a minute after our call, I realize that my bikini wax place happens to be on the same street. Not that I'll be needing those services for the foreseeable future, I think, which makes me start crying again. I pull it together long enough to dial Wendell's number, and of course, I get voicemail. Therapists rarely answer their office phones, so that patients won't feel rebuffed if they call in a crisis and their therapists have only a few minutes between sessions to speak. Colleague-to-colleague calls are made via cell phone or pager. I hear a generic outgoing recording. Hi, you've reached the office of Wendell Bronson. I return my calls during business hours Monday through Friday. If this is an emergency, please call. And after the beep, I leave a concise message with exactly the information a therapist wants. Name, one-liner about why I'm calling, and return phone number. I'm doing well until, thinking it might get me in to see him sooner, I add that I'm also a therapist. But my voice cracks as I say the word therapist. Mortified, I cover with a cough and quickly hang up. When Wendell calls me back an hour later, I try to sound as together as possible, as I explain that I just need a little crisis management, a few weeks to process an unexpected breakup, and then I'll be good to go. I've done therapy before, I say, so I come pre-shrunk. He doesn't laugh at my joke, so I'm pretty sure he has no sense of humor. But it doesn't matter, because I don't need a sense of humor for crisis management. This is, after all, just about getting me back on my feet. Wendell says about 5 words the entire call. I use the term words loosely because it's more like a bunch of uh-huhs before he offers a 9 o'clock appointment the next morning. I accept and we're done. Although Wendell didn't say much, our conversation provides me with immediate relief. I know this is a common placebo effect. Patients often feel hopeful after making that first appointment, before even setting foot in the therapy room. I'm no different. Tomorrow, I think, I'll get help with this. Yes, I'm a mess now because this whole thing is a shock, but soon I'll make sense of it. That is, Wendell will confirm that boyfriend is a sociopath. When I look back, this breakup will be a blip on the radar screen of my life. It will be a mistake that I will have learned from, the kind of mistake my son calls a beautiful oops. That night, before I go to sleep, I gather up boyfriend's things. his clothes, toiletries, tennis racket, books, and electronics, and pack them in a box that I'll give back to him. I take the Costco pajamas out of my drawer and find a post-it with a flirtatious note that boyfriend had stuck on one of them. When he wrote that, I wonder, did he already know he was leaving? At a case consultation I went to the week before the breakup, a colleague brought up a patient who found out that her husband had been leading a double life. Not only had he been having an affair for years, but he'd gotten the woman pregnant, and she was about to have his baby. When his wife discovered all of this, was he ever going to tell her? She no longer knew what to make of her life with him. Were her memories real? For example, that romantic vacation. Was her version of the trip accurate? Or was it some fiction, given that he was having his affair at that time? She felt robbed of her marriage, but also of her memories. Likewise, when boyfriend put the post-it on my pajamas, when he bought me the pajamas in the first place, was he also secretly planning his kid-free life? I frown at the note. Liar, I think. I walk the box out to the car and place it on the front seat so I'll remember to drop it off. Maybe I'll even do it in the morning, on my way to my appointment with Wendell. I can't wait for him to tell me what a sociopath boyfriend is. Chapter 7. The Beginning of Knowing. I'm standing in the doorway of Wendell's office, trying to figure out where to sit. I see a lot of therapy offices in my profession, my supervisor's offices during training, my colleagues' offices that I visit. But I've never seen one like Wendell's. Yes, there are the usual diplomas on the walls and therapy-related books on the shelves, along with the conspicuous absence of anything that might give away his personal life. No family photos on the desk, for instance, just a lone laptop. But instead of the standard setup of the therapist chair in the middle of the room with seating against the walls, during internship, we learned to sit close to the door in case things escalated and we needed an escape route. Wendell's office has two long sofas on the far walls, arranged in an L shape with a side table between them, and no therapist chair at all. I'm flummoxed. Wendell, who is very tall and very thin, with a balding head and the stooped posture of our profession, stands there waiting for me to take a seat. I consider the possibilities. I assume we won't sit side by side on the same sofa, but which sofa does he typically take? The one by the window? So he can escape through that if things escalate? Or the one by the wall? I decide to take a seat by the window, position A, before he closes the door, walks across the room, and relaxes into position C. Alt. I decide to take a seat by the window, before he closes the door, walks across the room, and relaxes. Generally, when I see a new patient, I'll open the conversation with an icebreaker like, "So, tell me what brings you here today." Wendell, however, says nothing. He just looks at me, his green eyes questioning. He's wearing a cardigan, khakis, and loafers, like he came straight from Therapist Central casting. "Hi," I say. "Hi," he replies. And he waits. About a minute passes, which is longer than it sounds, and I try to gather my wits so that I can clearly lay out the boyfriend situation. The truth is, every day since the breakup has been worse than the night of the breakup itself, because now a glaring void has opened up in my life. For the past couple of years, boyfriend and I had been in constant contact throughout our days, had said goodnight every bedtime. Now what was he doing? How had his day gone? Did his presentation at work go well? Was he thinking about me? Or was he glad to have gotten the truth off his chest so he could go search for somebody who was kid-free? I felt his absence in every cell of my body, so by the time I get to Wendell's office this morning, I'm a wreck. But I don't want that to be his first impression of me. Or, to be honest, his second or hundredth. An interesting paradox of the therapy process. In order to do their job, therapists try to see patients as they really are, which means noticing their vulnerabilities and entrenched patterns and struggles. Patients, of course, want to be helped, but they also want to be liked and admired. In other words, they want to hide their vulnerabilities and entrenched patterns and struggles. That's not to say that therapists don't look for a patient's strengths and try to build on those. We do. But while we aim to discover what's not working, patients try to keep the illusion going to avoid shame, to seem more together than they really are. Both parties have the well-being of the patient in mind, but often work at cross purposes in the service of a mutual goal. As calmly as possible, I begin to tell Wendell the boyfriend story. But almost immediately, my dignity's gone and I'm sobbing. I go through the entire story play by play, and by the time I'm done, my hands are covering my face, my body is shaking, and I think about what Jen said on the phone when she called to check on me yesterday. You need to find a place where you're not being a therapist. I'm definitely not being a therapist right now. I'm making the case for why boyfriend must be blamed for all of this. If he hadn't been so avoidant, Jen's diagnosis, I wouldn't have been so blindsided. And, I add, he must be a sociopath. Again, quoting Jen, this is exactly the reason therapists can't see their friends for therapy. Because I had no idea that he felt this way. He was such a good actor. And even if he's not a certifiable sociopath, he's clearly missing a few marbles, because who keeps something this big to himself for God knows how long? After all, I know what normal communication looks like, especially because I see so many couples in my practice, and besides... I look up, and I think I see Wendell suppress a smile. I imagine his thought bubble. This wacko's a therapist? Who treats couples? But it's hard to tell because I can't see very well. It's like looking through the windshield of a car without its wipers on during a storm. In a strange way, I'm relieved to be able to cry this hard in front of another person, even if that person is a stranger who doesn't say much. After a bunch of empathetic mms, Wendell asks a question. Is this a typical breakup reaction for you? His tone is kind, but I know what he's getting at. He's trying to determine what's known as my attachment style. Attachment styles are formed early in childhood based on our interactions with our caregivers. Attachment styles are significant because they play out in people's adult relationships too, influencing the kinds of partners they pick, stable or less stable, how they behave during the course of a relationship, needy, distant, or volatile, and how their relationships tend to end, wistfully, amiably, or with a huge explosion. The good news is that maladaptive attachment styles can be modified in adulthood. This, in fact, is a lot of the work of therapy. No, this isn't typical, I insist, using my sleeve to dry my tears. I let him know that I've had long-term relationships, and I've gone through breakups, but not like this. And, I reiterate, the only reason I'm having this reaction is that this particular breakup was such a shock, so out of left field. And isn't what boyfriend did the most confusing and bizarre and unethical thing to do to someone? I'm sure that this married professional with kids is going to say something supportive right now about how painful it is to be blindsided, but that in the long run, thank goodness this happened, because I dodged a bullet, not just for me, but for my son. I sit back, take a breath, and wait for the validation to pour in. But Wendell doesn't offer any. Of course, I didn't expect him to call boyfriend trash, as Allison had. A therapist would use more neutral language, such as, it sounds like he had a lot of feelings that he didn't communicate directly to you. Still, Wendell says nothing. My tears are starting to spill onto my pants again when, out of the corner of my eye, I see an object flying through the air toward me. At first, it looks like a football, and I wonder if I'm hallucinating from the 0 hours of restful sleep I've gotten since the breakup. But then I realize that it's a brown box of tissues, the one that was on the end table between the sofas, next to the seat I didn't take. Instinctively, my hands fly up to catch it, but I miss. It lands with a thud on the cushion next to me, and I grab a bunch of tissues and blow my nose. Having the box there seems to narrow the space between Wendell and me, as if he just threw me a lifeline. Over the years, I've handed tissue boxes to patients countless times, but I'd forgotten how cared for that simple gesture can make someone feel. A phrase I heard in graduate school pops into my head: the therapeutic act, not the therapeutic word. I take more tissues and wipe my eyes. Wendell is watching me, waiting. I continue talking about boyfriend and his avoidance issues, building a case using details from his past, including the way his marriage ended, which wasn't dissimilar to how our relationship ended in terms of shock value for his wife and kids. I'm telling Wendell everything I knew about boyfriend's history of avoidance, without realizing that what I'm unintentionally illustrating is my avoidance of his avoidance, about which, apparently, I knew quite a bit. Wendell tilts his head slightly, a questioning smile on his face. It's curious, isn't it, given what you knew about his history, that this is such a shock to you. But it is a shock, I say. He'd never said anything about not wanting a kid in the house. In fact, he just talked to HR at his firm to make sure that he could put my son on his benefits policy once we were married. I go over the entire chronology again, adding more evidence to support my story. Then notice that Wendell's face is starting to cloud over. I know I'm being repetitive, I say. But you have to understand, I was expecting that we would spend the rest of our lives together. This was how things were supposed to go, and now it's all up in the air. Half my life is over, and I have no idea what's going to happen. What if boyfriend was the last person I fall in love with? What if he was the end of the line? The end of the line? Wendell perks up. Yeah, the end of the line, I say. He waits for me to continue, but instead my tears return. Not the wild sobs of the past week, but something both calmer and deeper. Quieter. I know that you feel caught by surprise, Wendell says. But I'm also interested in something else you said. Half your life is over. Maybe what you're grieving isn't just the breakup, though I know this experience feels devastating. He pauses, and when he speaks again, his voice is softer. I wonder if you're grieving something bigger than the loss of your boyfriend. He looks at me meaningfully, like he just said something incredibly important and profound. But I kind of want to punch him. What a load of garbage, I think. I mean, really. I was fine, more than fine. I was fine plus before this turn of events. I have a child I adore beyond measure. I have a career I enjoy immensely. I have a supportive family and amazing friends whom I care about and who care about me. I'm grateful for this life. Okay, sometimes I'm grateful. I certainly try to be grateful. And now I'm frustrated. I'm paying this therapist to help me with a painful breakup, and this is what he has to offer? Grieving something bigger my ass. Before I can say this, I notice that Wendell is looking at me in a way I'm not used to being looked at. His eyes are like magnets, and every time I glance away, they seem to find me. His expression is intense but gentle, a combination of a wise elder and a stuffed animal. And it comes with a message. In this room, I'm going to see you, and you'll try to hide, but I'll still see you. And it's going to be okay when I do. But I'm not here for that. As I told Wendell when I called to schedule the appointment, I just need some crisis management. I'm really just here to get through the breakup, I say. I feel like I've been tossed in a blender and can't get out, and that's all I'm here for, to find a way out. Okay, Wendell says, graciously backing off. Help me understand more about the relationship. He's trying to establish what's known as a therapeutic alliance, a trust that has to develop before any work can get done. In the early sessions, it's always more important for patients to feel heard and understood than it is for them to gain any insight or make any changes. Relieved, I go back to talking about boyfriend, rehashing the whole thing. But he knows. He knows what all therapists know. That the presenting problem, the issue somebody comes in with, is often just one aspect of a larger problem, if not a red herring entirely. He knows that most people are brilliant at finding ways to filter out the things they don't want to look at using distractions or defenses to keep threatening feelings at bay. He knows that pushing aside emotions only makes them stronger, but that before he goes in and destroys somebody's defense, whether that defense is obsessing about another person or pretending not to see what's in plain sight, he needs to help the patient replace the defense with something else, so that he doesn't have to leave the person raw and exposed with no protection whatsoever. As the term implies, defenses serve a useful purpose. They shield people from injury. until they no longer need them. It's in this ellipsis that therapists work. Meanwhile, back on my couch, clutching the tissue box, a small part of me knows something too. As much as I want validation, somewhere inside, I know that Wendell's load of garbage is precisely what I'm paying him for. Because if I just want to complain about boyfriend, I can do that for free, with my family and friends, at least until their patience runs out. I know that often people create faulty narratives to make themselves feel better in the moment, even though it makes them feel worse over time, and that sometimes they need somebody else to read between the lines. But I also know this. Boyfriend is a goddamn motherfucking selfish sociopath. I'm in that space between knowing and not knowing. That's all we can do with this today, Wendell says, and following his gaze, I notice for the first time that his clock has been resting on the windowsill over my shoulder. He lifts his arms and gives his legs two loud pats, as if to punctuate the session's end, a gesture that I'll soon come to recognize as his signature sign-off. Then he rises and escorts me to the door. He says to let him know if I'd like to come back next Wednesday. I think about the week ahead, the void where boyfriend used to be, and the comfort of, as Jen said, having a place to completely fall apart. Sign me up, I say. I walk across the street to the lot where I used to park for my bikini waxes, and I feel both lighter and like I might vomit. A supervisor once likened doing psychotherapy to undergoing physical therapy. It can be difficult and cause pain, and your condition can worsen before it improves. But if you go consistently and work hard when you're there, you'll get the kinks out and function so much better. I check my phone. A text from Allison. Remember, he's trash. An email from a patient needing to move her session. A voicemail from my mom wondering if I'm okay. No message from boyfriend. I'm still hoping he'll call. I can't understand how he could be fine while I'm suffering so much. At least he seemed fine when we coordinated my returning his belongings this morning. Had he gotten through his sadness months ago, knowing that eventually he was going to end things? If so, how could he have kept talking about our future together? How could he send I love you emails just hours before what was to become our last conversation, at the start of which we made movie plans for the weekend? Did he go see the movie? I wonder. I start to stew again on the drive to the office. By the time I pull into my building's parking garage, I'm thinking about the fact that not only has boyfriend wasted 2 years of my life, but now I'm going to have to deal with the fallout by going to therapy, and I don't have time for any of this because I'm in my 40s now and half my life is over and, oh my God, there it is again. Half my life is over. I've never said that to myself or anyone else before. Why does it keep popping up? You're grieving something bigger, Wendell had said. But I forget all about this as soon as I step into the elevator at work. Chapter 8. Rosie. Well, it's official, John says, after slipping off his shoes and sitting cross-legged on the sofa. I'm surrounded by idiots. His phone vibrates. As he reaches for it, I raise my eyebrows. In return, John gives me an exaggerated eye roll. It's our fourth session together, and I've started to form some initial impressions. I get the sense that, despite all the people surrounding him, John is desperately isolated, and that this is by design. Something in his life has made getting close seem dangerous, so dangerous that he does everything in his power to prevent it. His arsenal is effective. He insults me, goes on long tangents, changes the subject, and interrupts whenever I attempt to speak. But unless I can find a way to get past his defenses, we'll have no chance of making headway. One of these defenses is his cell phone. Last week, after John began texting in session, I brought his attention to my experience of feeling dismissed when he texts. This is called working in the here and now. Instead of focusing on a patient's stories from the outside world, the here and now is about what's occurring in the room. You can bet that whatever a patient does with his therapist, he also does with others. And I wanted John to begin to see the impact he had on people. I knew I ran the risk of pushing too far too soon, but I remembered a detail about his earlier therapy. It had lasted just 3 sessions, exactly where we were. I didn't know how long I'd have with him. I was guessing that John had left his previous therapist for one of two reasons. Either she didn't call him on his bullshit, which makes patients feel unsafe, like children whose parents don't hold them accountable, or she did call him on his bullshit, but she moved too fast and committed the same mistake I was potentially about to make. I was willing to risk it, though. I wanted John to feel comfortable in therapy, but not so comfortable that I wasn't helping him. Above all, I didn't want to fall into the trap that Buddhists call idiot compassion, an apt phrase given John's worldview. In idiot compassion, you avoid rocking the boat to spare people's feelings, even though the boat needs rocking and your compassion ends up being more harmful than your honesty. People do this with teenagers, spouses, addicts, even themselves. Its opposite is wise compassion, which means caring about the person but also giving him or her a loving truth bomb when needed. "You know, John," I'd said the week before as he texted away, "I'm curious if you have any reaction to my feeling dismissed when you do this." He held up a finger, "Hang on," but continued to text. When he finished, he looked up at me. "Sorry, what was I saying?" I loved that. Not what were you saying, but what was I saying? "Well," I began, but his phone pinged, and off he went, responding to another text. "See, this is what I mean," he grumbled. "I can't delegate anything if I want it done right. Just a sec." Judging by the pings coming in, he seemed to be having multiple conversations. I wondered if we were reenacting a scene that played out with his wife. "Margot, pay attention to me. John, who, you?" It was profoundly annoying. What to do with my annoyance? I could sit and wait and become more irritated. Or I could do something else. I stood up, walked over to my desk, searched through a file, picked up my cell phone, walked back to my chair, and started texting. "It's me, your therapist. I'm over here." John's phone pinged. I watched him read my text, surprised.
"Jesus Christ, you're texting me now?"
I smiled.
"I wanted to get your attention."
"You have my attention," he said, but he kept on texting. "I don't feel like I have your attention. I feel ignored and a bit insulted." Ping. John sighed dramatically, then resumed his texting. "And I don't think I can help you unless we're able to give each other our full attention. So if you'd like to try to work together, I'm going to ask that you not use your phone in here." Ping.
"What?"
John said, looking up at me.
"You're banning my cell phone? Like I'm on an airplane? You can't do that. It's my session."
I shrugged. "I don't want to waste your time." I didn't tell John that our sessions aren't, in fact, his alone. Every therapy session belongs to both patient and therapist, to the interaction between them. It was the psychoanalyst Harry Stack Sullivan who, in the early 20th century, developed a theory of psychiatry based on interpersonal relationships, breaking away from Freud's position that mental disorders were intrapsychic in origin, meaning in one's mind. Sullivan believed that our struggles were interactional, meaning relational. He went so far as to say, "It's the mark of a senior clinician that he or she is the same person in their living room that they are in their office." We can't teach patients to be relational if we aren't relational with them. John's phone pinged again, but this time it wasn't me. He looked between me and his phone, deliberating. As his internal battle waged, I waited it out. I was half prepared for him to get up and leave, but I also knew that if he didn't want to be here, he wouldn't have come. Whether he understood it or not, he was getting something out of this. I was likely the only person in his life right now who would listen to him.
"Oh, for God's sake," he said, tossing his cell onto the chair across the room. "Okay, I'll put down the goddamned phone."
Then he changed the subject. I expected his anger, but for a second, it looked as if his eyes had moistened. Was that sadness? Or was that a reflection from the sun streaming in the window? I toyed with inquiring, but there was only a minute left in the session, a time usually reserved for putting people back together rather than opening them up. I decided to file it away for a more opportune moment. Like a miner spotting a glimmer of gold, I suspected that I'd hit on something.
Today, with much restraint, John stops mid-reach, leaving his vibrating phone alone, and continues his story about being officially surrounded by idiots. Even Rosie's being idiotic, he says. I'm surprised to hear him talk this way about his daughter, who's 4. I tell her not to go near my laptop, and what does she do? She jumps on the bed, which is fine, but it's not fine to jump on the laptop that's on the bed, idiot. And then as soon as I yell no, she pees on the bed, ruined the mattress. She hasn't peed on anything since she was a baby. This story concerns me. There's a myth that therapists are trained to be neutral. But how can we be? We're humans, not robots. In fact, instead of being neutral, we therapists strive to notice our very unneutral feelings and biases and opinions, what we call countertransference, so that we can step back and figure out what to do with them. We use, rather than suppress, our feelings to help guide the treatment. And this story about Rosie raises my hackles. Many parents have yelled at their kids in their less-than-glorious parenting moments. But I wonder about John's relationship with his daughter. When working with couples on empathy, often I'll say, before you speak, ask yourself, what is this going to feel like to the person I'm speaking to? I make a mental note to share this with John one day. That sounds frustrating, I say. Do you think you might have scared her? A loud voice can be frightening. Nah, I yell at her all the time, he says. The louder the better. Only way she listens. The only way? I ask. Well, when she was younger, I would go outside and run around with her, let her blow off some steam. Sometimes she just needed to be outside. But lately, she's been a real pain in the ass. She even tried to bite me. Why? She wanted to play with me, but, oh, you'll love this. I know what's coming. I was texting, so she had to wait, and she just lost her shit. Margot was out of town, so Rosie was spending her days with her Danny and... Remind me, who's Danny? Not Danny. Her Danny. You know, a dog nanny. I stare back blankly. A dog sitter. A nanny for the dog. A Danny. Oh, so Rosie is your dog, I say. Well, who the hell did you think I was talking about? I thought your daughter's name was Ruby, he says. The little one is Ruby. Wasn't it obvious that I was talking about a dog here? He sighs and shakes his head as if I'm the biggest idiot in his kingdom of idiots. He never mentioned having a dog before. The fact that I remembered the first letter of his daughter's name, which was referenced only in passing 2 sessions ago, feels like a victory to me. But more than John's entitlement, what strikes me is this. He's showing me a softer side I haven't seen yet. You really love her, I say. Of course I do. She's my daughter. No, I mean Rosie. You care about her deeply. I'm trying to touch him in some way, to bring him closer to his emotions, which I know are there but atrophied, like a neglected muscle. He waves me away with his hand. She's a dog. What kind of dog is she? His face brightens. A mix. She's a rescue dog. She was a mess when we got her, because of those idiots who were supposed to be taking care of her. But now she's... I'll show you a photo if you'll let me use my goddamned phone. I nod. As he scrolls through his pictures, he smiles to himself. I'm looking for a good one, he says, so you can see how cute she really is. With each photo, he beams a bit more, and I glimpse his perfect teeth again. Here she is, he says proudly, handing me the phone. I look down at the picture. I happen to love dogs, but Rosie, God bless her, is one of the ugliest dogs I've ever seen. She has sagging jowls, uneven eyes, multiple bald patches, and a missing tail. John is still beaming, smitten. I can see how much you love her, I say, handing back the phone. I don't love her, she's a fucking dog. He sounds like a 5th-grade boy denying a crush on a classmate. John and Rosie sitting in a tree. Oh, I say gently. The way you talk about her, I hear a lot of love there. Would you stop saying that? His tone is irritated, but I see pain in his eyes. I think back to our previous session. Something about love or caring must feel painful for him. With a different patient, I might ask why what I'm saying is so upsetting. but I know that John will avoid the topic by arguing with me about whether he loves his dog. Instead, I say, most people who have pets care about them deeply. I lower my voice so that he almost has to lean in to hear me. Neuroscientists discovered that humans have brain cells called mirror neurons that cause them to mimic others. And when people are in a heightened state of emotion, a soothing voice can calm their nervous systems and help them stay present. Whether it's called love or something else, it doesn't really matter.
This is a ridiculous conversation, John says. He's looking down at the floor. But I can see that I've got his full attention.
You brought up Rosie for a reason today. She matters to you, and now she's acting in a way that concerns you, because you care.
People matter to me, John says. My wife, my kids, people.
He glances toward his cell, which is vibrating again, but I don't follow his gaze. I stay with him, trying to hold on so he won't get pulled away whenever an unwanted feeling appears and go numb. People often mistake numbness for nothingness, but numbness isn't the absence of feelings. It's a response to being overwhelmed by too many feelings. John looks from his cell back to me.
You know what I love about Rosie? He says. She's the only one who doesn't ask things of me. The only one who isn't, in one way or another, disappointed with me. Or at least, she wasn't before she bit me. Who wouldn't love that?
He laughs loudly, like we're at a bar and he's just tossed out a breezy one-liner. I try to talk about the disappointment. Who's disappointed with him and why? But he claims it was just a joke, and can I take a joke? And though we get nowhere with this today, we both know what he told me. He has a heart under those quills and the capacity for love. For starters, he adores that hideous dog.
Chapter 9. Snapshots of Ourselves. People who come to therapy present snapshots of themselves, and from these snapshots, a therapist has to extrapolate. Patients arrive, if not at their worst, then certainly not at their best. They might be despairing or defensive, confused or chaotic. Generally, they're in very bad moods. So they sit on the therapist's couch and look up expectantly, hoping to find some understanding and eventually, but preferably immediately, a cure. But therapists don't have an immediate cure because these people are complete strangers to us. We need time to acquaint ourselves with their hopes and dreams, their feelings and behavior patterns, sometimes more deeply than even they have. If it takes from birth to the day they arrive in our offices to develop whatever is troubling them, or if a problem has been incubating for many months, it makes sense that they might need more than a couple of 50-minute sessions to attain the desired relief. But when people are in extremis, they want their therapists, these professionals, to do something. Patients want our patience, but may not have much patience themselves. Their demands can be overt or tacit, and especially in the beginning, they can weigh heavily on the therapist. Why would we choose a profession that requires us to meet unhappy, distressed, abrasive, or unaware people and sit with them, one after the other, alone in a room? The answer is this. Because therapists know that at first, each patient is simply a snapshot, a person captured in a particular moment. It's like a photo of you taken from an unfortunate angle and with a sour expression on your face. There might also be a photo in which you're glowing, caught opening a present or mid-laugh with a lover. Both are you in that fraction of time, and neither is you in your entirety. So therapists listen, suggest, nudge, guide, and occasionally cajole our patients to bring other snapshots into view, to shift their experience of what's happening inside and around them. We sort through the snapshots, and before long it becomes apparent that these seemingly discrete images all revolve around a common theme, one that might not have been in our patients' fields of vision when they decided to come in. Some snapshots are disturbing, and glimpsing them reminds me that we all have a dark side. Others are blurry. People don't always remember events or conversations clearly, but they do remember with great accuracy how an experience made them feel. Therapists have to be interpreters of these blurry snapshots,
aware that patients need to be fuzzy to some extent, because those first snapshots help to gloss over painful feelings that might be invading their peaceful inner territory. In time, they find out that they aren't at war after all, that the path to peace is to call a truce with themselves. Which is why when people first come in, we're imagining them down the line. We do this not just on that first day, but in every single session, because that image allows us to hold for them the hope that they can't yet muster themselves, and it informs how the treatment unfolds. I once heard creativity described as being the ability to grasp the essence of one thing and the essence of some very different thing and smash them together to create some entirely new thing. That's what therapists do too. We take the essence of the initial snapshot and the essence of an imagined snapshot and smash them together to create an entirely new one. I have this in mind each time I meet a new patient. I hope that Wendell does too, because in those early sessions, my snapshots are, well, not flattering. Chapter 10. The future is also the present. Today, I'm early for my appointment, so I sit in Wendell's waiting room and take a look around. Turns out his waiting room is as unusual as his therapy room. Instead of professional-looking furniture and the usual art, a framed poster of an abstract painting, maybe an African mask, the aesthetic in here is grandma's hand-me-downs. There's even a musty smell to go with it. In a corner are two worn, high-backed dining chairs in an outdated, paisley gold brocade fabric, an equally worn and outdated rug on top of the beige wall-to-wall carpet, and a credenza covered by a stained lace tablecloth topped with doilies. Doilies! And a vase of fake flowers. On the floor between the chairs is a white noise machine, and in front of them, in lieu of a coffee table, is what probably used to be a living room side table, now nicked and chipped and covered by a mess of magazines. A paper folding screen shields this seating area from the path leading in and out of Wendell's office, so that patients have some privacy, but you can still see clearly through the hinged openings. I know I'm not here for the decor, but I find myself wondering, can somebody with such bad taste help me? Is this a reflection of his judgment? An acquaintance told me that she'd been profoundly distracted by the crooked pictures hanging in her therapist's office. Why wouldn't she just straighten the damn things? For about 5 minutes, I glance at the magazine covers. Time, Parents, Vanity Fair. And then the door to the therapy room opens and out walks a woman. She whizzes behind the screen, but I can tell in the split second I see her that she's pretty, well-dressed and tearful. Then Wendell appears in the waiting area. I'll just be a minute, he says, and he heads into the hallway, presumably to use the restroom. As I wait, I wonder what the pretty woman was crying about. When Wendell returns, he gestures for me to enter his office. There's no hesitation at the doorway now. I go straight to position A by the window, he to position C by the side table, and I launch right in. Blah, 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 I begin. And if you can believe this, boyfriend said, blah, 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 blah. So I said, well, blah, blah, blah. Or at least that's what I'm sure it sounded like to Wendell. This goes on for a while. I've brought in pages of notes for this session, numbered, annotated, and in chronological order, just like I organized the interviews I did as a journalist before I became a therapist. I confessed to Wendell that I'd caved and phoned boyfriend, and that he'd let it go to voicemail. Humiliated, I had to wait a full day for him to call me back, knowing the entire time that the last thing anyone wants to do is talk to the person he's just broken up with, but who still wants to be together. You're probably going to ask what I wanted to get out of calling him, I say, anticipating his next question. Wendell raises his right eyebrow. Just the one, I notice, and I wonder how he does that. But before he can respond, I plow ahead. First, I explain, I wanted boyfriend to tell me that he missed me, and this was all a big mistake. But barring that unlikely possibility, added so that Wendell knows I have self-awareness, even though I believed that boyfriend would tell me he'd reconsidered, I wanted to get clear on how we had arrived at this point. If I could just get my questions answered, I'd stop going over the breakup in my head ad nauseam, in an infinite loop of confusion. Which is why, I tell Wendell, I subjected boyfriend to a several-hour interrogation. I mean, conversation, in which I tried to solve the mystery of what the fuck led to our sudden breakup. And then he says, being around a kid is limiting and distracting, I go on, reading verbatim quotes. It never would have been enough alone time with you, and I realized that no matter how great the kid, I'm never going to want to live with any child other than my own. So then I said, why did you hide all this from me? And he said, because I needed to figure it out before I said anything. And then I said, but don't you think we should have discussed this? And he said, what's to discuss? It's binary. Either I could live with a kid or I couldn't. And only I could figure that out. And just as my brain is about to burst, he says, I really love you, but love doesn't conquer all. It's binary, I say to Wendell, shaking my papers in the air. I put an asterisk next to this word in my notes. Binary. If it's so binary, why get into the binary situation in the first place? I'm insufferable, and I know it, but I can't stop. For the next several weeks, I come to Wendell's office and report the details of my circular conversations with boyfriend. Admittedly, there are several more, while Wendell tries to interject something useful. But he's not sure how this is helping me, that this feels masochistic, that I keep telling the same story hoping for a different outcome. He says that I want boyfriend to explain himself to me, and that he is explaining himself to me, but that I keep going back because his explanation isn't what I want to hear. Wendell says that if I've been taking such copious notes during our phone calls, I probably haven't been able to listen to boyfriend, and if my goal is to be open to understanding his perspective, that's hard to do when I'm trying to prove a point rather than have an interaction in earnest. And, he adds, I'm doing the same thing to him in our sessions. I agree, then go right back to railing against boyfriend. In one session, I explain with excruciating specificity the arrangements for getting boyfriend's belongings returned to him. In another, I repeatedly ask, am I crazy or is he? Wendell says neither of us is crazy, which infuriates me. Another consists of an analysis of what kind of person says, I want to marry you, just not you with a kid. For this session, I've created an infographic on gender differences. A man can say, I don't want to have to look at the Legos, and I'll never love a kid who's not mine, and get away with it. A woman who said that would be crucified. I also pepper our sessions with reports of what I've discovered in my daily Google stalking. The women boyfriend must be dating, based on elaborate stories I create from social media likes. How fabulous his life is without me, based on his tweets about his business trip. How he isn't even sad about the breakup, because he photographs salads in restaurants. How can he even eat? I'm convinced that boyfriend has quickly transitioned into his post-me life completely unscathed. It's a refrain I recognize from divorcing couples I see, in which one person is struggling mightily and the other seems fine, happy even, to be moving on. I tell Wendell that, like these patients, I want some sign of the scar tissue left behind. I want to know, in the end, that I mattered. Did I matter? I ask over and over. I continue like this, letting my freak flag fly, until finally, Wendell kicks me. One morning, as I drone on about boyfriend, Wendell scoots to the edge of his couch, stands up, walks over to me, and with his very long leg, lightly kicks my foot. Smiling, he returns to a seat. Ouch, I say reflexively, even though it didn't hurt. I'm startled. What was that? Well, you seem like you're enjoying the experience of suffering. So I thought I'd help you out with that. What? There's a difference between pain and suffering, Wendell says. You're going to have to feel pain. Everyone feels pain at times. But you don't have to suffer so much. You're not choosing the pain, but you're choosing the suffering. He goes on to explain that all of this perseverating I'm doing, all of this endless rumination and speculation about boyfriend's life, is adding to the pain and causing me to suffer. So, he suggests, if I'm clinging to the suffering so tightly, I must be getting something out of it. It must be serving some purpose for me. Is it?
I think about why I might be obsessively Google-stalking boyfriend, despite how bad I know it makes me feel. Is it a way to stay connected to boyfriend and his daily routine, even if it's only one-sided? Maybe. Is it a way to numb out so I don't have to think about the reality of what happened? Possibly. Is it a way of avoiding what I should be paying attention to in my life, but don't want to? Earlier, Wendell had pointed out that I'd kept my distance from boyfriend, ignoring clues that would have made his revelation less shocking, because if I'd inquired about them, boyfriend might have said something I didn't want to hear. I told myself it meant nothing that he seemed irritated by kids in public places, that he'd happily run errands for us rather than attend my son's basketball games, that he said it was more important to his ex-wife than to him to have children when they were having fertility problems, and that his brother and sister-in-law stayed in a hotel when they came to visit because boyfriend didn't want the commotion of their three kids in his house. And yet, neither he nor I had ever discussed our feelings about children directly. I figured, he's a dad. He likes kids. Wendell and I talked about my pretending away certain parts of boyfriend's history and comments and body language to quiet the alarm that might have gone off if I'd paid them heed. And now, Wendell wonders, if I've been keeping my distance from him as well, obsessing over my notes and sitting far away from him in order to protect myself here, too. I glance at the L-shaped sofa configuration. Don't most people sit here? I ask from my seat under the window. I'm certain that nobody shares a sofa with him, so that rules out position D. And as for position B, catty corner to him, who would sit that close to the therapist? Again, nobody. Some do, Wendell says. Really? Where? Anywhere along here. Wendell gestures from where I'm sitting all the way to position B. Suddenly, the distance between us seems vast, but I still can't believe that people sit that close to Wendell. So somebody walks into your office for the very first time, scans the room, and then plops down right there, even though you're going to be sitting just inches away? They do, Wendell says simply. I think about the tissue box that Wendell had tossed to me and how he kept it on the table next to position B, because, it occurs to me now, most people must sit there. Oh, I say. Should I move? Wendell shrugs. It's up to you. I get up and sit down perpendicular to Wendell. I have to adjust my legs to the side so that they don't touch his. I notice a bit of gray at the roots of his dark hair, the wedding ring on his finger. I remember asking Caroline to refer me, or my friend, to a married male therapist. But now that I'm here, I realize it doesn't really matter. He hasn't sided with me or declared boyfriend a sociopath. I adjust the pillows and try to get comfortable. This feels strange. I look down at my notes, but I have no interest in reading them right now. I feel exposed and have the urge to run. I can't sit here, I say. Wendell asks why, and I tell him I don't know. Not knowing is a good place to start, he says. And this feels like a revelation. I spend so much time trying to figure things out, chasing the answer. But it's okay to not know. We're both quiet for a while. Then I get up and move farther away, about midway between positions A and B. I can breathe again. I think of a Flannery O'Connor quote, "The truth does not change according to our ability to stomach it." What am I protecting myself from? What do I not want Wendell to see? All along, I'd been telling Wendell that I didn't wish ill upon boyfriend, like having his next girlfriend blindside him. I just wanted our relationship back. I said with a straight face that I didn't want revenge, that I didn't hate boyfriend, that I wasn't angry, just confused. Wendell listened, but said he wasn't buying it. Obviously, I did want revenge. I did hate boyfriend. I was furious. Your feelings don't have to mesh with what you think they should be, he explained. They'll be there regardless, so you might as well welcome them, because they hold important clues. How many times had I said something similar to my own patients? But here I feel as if I'm hearing this for the first time. Don't judge your feelings. Notice them. Use them as your map. Don't be afraid of the truth. My friends, my family, like me,
They've had trouble considering the possibility that boyfriend is a decent guy who was confused and conflicted. Instead, he was either selfish or a liar. They've also never considered that, even though boyfriend told himself that he couldn't live with a kid, maybe he also couldn't live with me. Maybe, in ways he didn't realize, I reminded him too much of his parents or ex-wife, or the woman he once mentioned who had hurt him deeply in graduate school. I made a decision never to go through anything like that again, he had said early in our relationship. I'd asked him to explain more, but he didn't want to talk about it, and I, colluding with his avoidance, didn't push it. Wendell, though, has been asking me to look at the ways we avoided each other by hiding behind romance and banter and plans for our future. And now I'm in pain and creating my own suffering, and my therapist is literally trying to kick some sense into me. He switches his crossed legs from right over left to left over right, something therapists do when their legs start to fall asleep. His striped socks match his striped cardigan today, as if they came as a set. He points with his chin to the papers in my hand. I don't think you're going to get the answers you're looking for from these notes. You're grieving something bigger, pops into my head, like a song lyric I can't shake. But if I don't talk about the breakup, I won't have anything to say, I insist. Wendell tilts his head. You'll have the important things to say. I hear him and I don't. Whenever Wendell implies that this is bigger than boyfriend, I push back. So I suspect that he must be onto something. The things we protest against the most are often the very things we need to look at. Maybe, I say, but I feel antsy. Right now, I feel like I need to finish telling you what boyfriend said. Can I just tell you one last thing? He takes in a breath and then stops, hesitating, like he was about to say something but decided against it. Sure, Wendell says. He's pushed me enough and knows it. He's taken away my drug, talking about boyfriend, for a minute too long, and I need another fix. I start rifling through the pages, but now I can't remember where I was. I'm scanning the notes to see which damning quote I should share next, but there are so many asterisks and so many notes, and I can feel Wendell's eyes on me. I wonder what I would be thinking if somebody like me were sitting in my therapy room right now. Actually, I know. I'd be thinking of the laminated sign that my office mate posted inside the files at work. There is a continuing decision to be made as to whether to evade pain or to tolerate it and therefore modify it. I put down the notes. Okay, I say to Wendell. What did you want to say? Wendell explains that my pain feels like it's in the present, but it's actually in both the past and the future. Therapists talk a lot about how the past informs the present, how our histories affect the ways we think, feel, and behave, and how at some point in our lives, we have to let go of the fantasy of creating a better past. If we don't accept the notion that there's no redo, much as we try to get our parents or siblings or partners to fix what happened years ago, our pasts will keep us stuck. Changing our relationship to the past is a staple of therapy. But we talk far less about how our relationship to the future informs the present, too. Our notion of the future can be just as powerful a roadblock to change as our notion of the past. In fact, Wendell continues, I've lost more than my relationship in the present. I've lost my relationship in the future. We tend to think that the future happens later, but we're creating it in our minds every day. When the present falls apart, so does the future we had associated with it. And having the future taken away is the mother of all plot twists. But if we spend the present trying to fix the past or control the future, we remain stuck in place, in perpetual regret. By Google stalking boyfriend, I've been watching his future unfold while I stay frozen in the past. But if I live in the present, I'll have to accept the loss of my future. Can I sit through the pain? Or do I want to suffer? So, I say to Wendell, I guess I should stop interrogating boyfriend and Google stalking him. He smiles indulgently, the way one would at a smoker who announces that she'll quit cold turkey, but doesn't realize how overly ambitious that is. Or at least try, I say, backtracking. Spend less time on his future, more on my present. Wendell nods, then pats his legs twice and stands. The session is over, but I want to stay. I feel like we just got started.
Chapter 11. Goodbye, Hollywood. My first week working at NBC, I was assigned to two shows that were about to premiere, ER, a medical drama, and Friends, a sitcom. These shows would catapult the network to number one and establish its Thursday night dominance for years to come. The series were set to air in the fall, following a much faster cycle than in the film world. Within months, casts and crews were hired, sets were built, and production began. I was in the room when Jennifer Aniston and Courtney Cox auditioned for starring roles in Friends. I weighed in on whether Juliana Margulies' character in ER should die at the end of episode one, and I was on the set with George Clooney before anyone knew how famous this series would make him. Energized by this new job, I watched less TV at home. I had stories I was passionate about, and colleagues who were equally passionate about those stories, and I felt connected to my work again. One day, ER's writers called up a local emergency department with a medical question, and a physician named Joe happened to take the call. It seemed like kismet. In addition to his medical degree, he had a master's in film production. When the writers learned of Joe's background, they began to consult him regularly. Before long, they hired him as a technical advisor to block out the highly choreographed trauma bay scenes, teach the actors how to pronounce medical terms, and make the producers look as accurate as possible. Flush out the syringe, wipe the skin with alcohol before starting an IV, hold the patient's neck in this position when inserting a breathing tube. Of course, sometimes we skipped the surgical masks the characters should have worn, because everyone wanted to see George Clooney's face. On set, Joe was a study in competence and calm, the same qualities that served him in a real ER. During breaks, he would talk about patients he'd seen recently, and I'd want to hear every detail. What stories, I thought. One day, I asked Joe if I could visit him on the job. Research, I said, and he offered me access to his ER, where, in borrowed baggy scrubs, I followed him around during his shift. The drunk drivers and gang shootings don't start pouring in until dark, he explained, when I arrived on a Saturday afternoon and not much was going on. But soon we were rushing from room to room, patient to patient, as I tried to keep the names and charts and diagnoses straight. In the span of an hour, I watched Joe do a lumbar puncture, see inside a pregnant woman's uterus, and hold the hand of a 39-year-old mother of twins as she was told that her migraine was really a brain tumor. No, you see, we just wanted more migraine medicine, was her only response. Denial that would soon give way to a rush of tears. Her husband excused himself to go to the restroom but vomited on the way. For a second, I pictured this drama on TV. An ingrained instinct when your work is coming up with stories. But I had a sense that finding TV material wasn't only what being here was about for me. And Joe sensed that too. Week after week, I kept going back to the ER. You seem more interested in what we're doing here than in your day job, Joe said, one evening months later as we looked at an x-ray together, and he showed me where the fracture was. Then, almost as an afterthought, he said, you could still go to medical school, you know. Medical school? I said. I looked at him like he was nuts. I was 28 years old and had been a language major in college. It was true that in high school I'd competed in math and science tournaments, but outside of school, I'd always been drawn to words and stories. And now my work was a great job at NBC that I felt incredibly lucky to have. Even so, I kept sneaking away from tapings to go back to the ER. Not just with Joe, but with other doctors who let me shadow them, too. I knew that my being there had gone from research to hobby, but so what? Didn't everyone have hobbies? And okay, sure, maybe spending my evenings in the ER had become the new equivalent of obsessively watching TV every night when I was restless in my film job. Again, so what? I certainly wasn't about to give all this up and start over in medical school. Besides, I wasn't bored by the work at NBC. I just felt that something real and big and meaningful was happening in the ER that couldn't happen in the same way on television. And my hobby could fill in those blanks. That's what hobbies were for. But sometimes I'd be standing in the ER, and during a lull in the action, I'd realize how at home I felt. And more, I wondered if Joe was onto something.
Before long, my hobby led me out of the ER and into a neurosurgery suite. The case I'd been invited to see was that of a middle-aged man with a pituitary tumor that was likely benign, but had to be removed to keep it from pressing on his cranial nerves. Gowned and masked and wearing running shoes for comfort, I stood over Mr. Sanchez, peering into his skull. After sawing through the bone, using a tool like something you'd buy at Home Depot, the surgeon and his team meticulously pulled aside layer after layer of fascia until they reached his naked brain. Finally, there it was, looking just like the images I'd seen in a book the night before. But as I stood there, my own brain inches from Mr. Sanchez's, I felt a sense of awe. Everything that made this man himself, his personality, his memories, his experiences, his likes and dislikes, his loves and losses, his knowledge and abilities, was contained in this 3-pound organ. You lose a leg or a kidney, you're still you. But lose a part of your brain? Literally lose your mind? And who are you then? I had a perverse thought. I've gotten inside a person's head. Hollywood tried to get into people's heads all the time via market research and ads. But I was actually there, deep inside this man's skull. I wondered if those slogans the network bombarded viewers with ever made it to their destinations. It's must-see TV. As classical music played softly in the background, and two neurosurgeons picked away at the tumor, carefully depositing pieces of it onto a metal tray, I thought of the frenetic sets in Hollywood with all of their commotion and commands. Come on, people, let's go! An actor would be rushed down a hallway on a stretcher, red liquid drenching his clothes. But then someone would turn the corner too quickly. Shit, the director would say. Jesus, people, let's get it right this time! Burly men with cameras and lights would rush around in a frenzy, resetting the scene. I'd see a producer pop a pill. Tylenol or Xanax or Prozac. And down it with sparkling water. I'm gonna have a heart attack if we don't get this shot today, he'd sigh. I swear I'm gonna die. In the OR with Mr. Sanchez, there was no yelling, no one feeling as if a coronary was imminent. Even Mr. Sanchez, with his head sawed open, seemed less stressed out than the people on the set. As the surgical team worked, please and thank you peppered each request. And if it weren't for the steady stream of blood dripping out of a man's head and into a bag near my leg, I might have mistaken this place for fantasy. And in a way, it was. It was at once more real than anything I had ever seen, and also galaxies away from what I considered to be my actual life back in Hollywood, a place I had no intention of leaving. But months later, everything changed. I'm following an ER doctor in a county hospital on a Sunday. As we approach a curtain, he says, 45-year-old with complications from diabetes. He pulls back the curtain, and I see a woman lying on the table under a sheet. That's when the smell hits my nostrils. An assault so vile I worry I might faint. I can't identify the odor because I've never smelled anything this nauseating in my life. Has she defecated? Vomited? I see no signs of either, but the smell becomes so powerful that I feel the lunch I ate an hour ago rise into my throat, and I swallow hard to keep it down. I hope she can't see how pale I must be or sense the queasiness taking over my gut. I'm thinking, maybe it's coming from the next bed over. Maybe if I move more to this side of the room, I won't smell it so strongly. I concentrate on the woman's face. Watery eyes, reddish cheeks, bangs over her sweaty forehead. The doctor is asking her questions, and I can't understand how he manages to breathe. I've been trying to hold my breath this entire time, but I have to come up for air. Okay, I tell myself. Here goes. I take in some air and the smell seizes my body, steadying myself against the wall. I look on as the doctor lifts the sheet covering the woman's legs. Only, there are no lower legs. Her diabetes has caused severe vasculitis, and all that remain are two stumps above the knees. One has gangrene, and I can't decide if the sight of this infected stump, all black and moldy like a rotten fruit, is worse than its smell. The space is small, and I move closer to the woman's head, as far away from the infected stump as possible. And that's when something extraordinary happens. This woman takes my hand and smiles at me as if to say, I know this is hard to watch, but it's okay. Even though I'm the one who should be holding her hand, even though she's the one with the missing appendages and a massive infection, she's reassuring me. And though this could make a great storyline on ER, in that millisecond, I know I won't be working on that show much longer. I am going to medical school. Maybe that's an impulsive reason to change careers, the fact that this graceful stranger with a blackened stump is holding my hand as I try not to barf. But something is happening inside me that I've never felt at any of my Hollywood jobs. I still love TV, but there's something about the real stories I'm experiencing in person that seduce me and make the imaginary ones feel thin. Friends is about community, but a fake one. ER is about life and death, but they're fictional. Instead of taking these stories I witness and folding them back into my world at the network, I want real life, real people, to be my world. As I drive home from the hospital that day, I don't know how or when this might happen, or what kind of medical school loans I can get, or even if I can get in. I don't know how many science classes I'll have to take to meet the requirements and prepare for the MCAT, or where to take those courses, since I graduated from college 6 years ago. But somehow, I decide, I'm going to make this happen. And I can't do that while working 60-hour weeks on must-see TV. Chapter 12. Welcome to Holland. After Julie learned that she was dying, her best friend Dara, wanting to be helpful, sent her the well-known essay, Welcome to Holland, written by Emily Pearl Kingsley, the parent of a child with Down syndrome. It's about the experience of having your life's expectations turned upside down. When you're going to have a baby, it's like planning a fabulous vacation trip to Italy. You buy a bunch of